have that forcefully come out, I think it's going to have a lot of negative consequences that you may not realize.
Student representatives and the state school board share their thoughts with lawmakers on a controversial gender identity bill. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, March 17th. Good evening, I'm Wesley Early. Also tonight, remembering sport fishing advocate Bob Penny, who fell in love with the Kenai River in the 70s.
That definitely, if you'll pardon the pun, set the hook, and he has been addicted to that river ever since.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The future looks bright because the University of Alaska is on a mission to empower Alaska. From drone piloting to vital climate research to critical mining solutions, the University of Alaska's three universities and their community campuses shape the jobs and careers that fuel the economy, creating a more empowered Alaska for all. Learn more at empower.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
Students spoke out against Governor Mike Dunleavy's parental rights bill at a joint meeting of the House and Senate Education Committees on Wednesday. As KTOO's Katie Anastas reports, the students told legislators it could put their LGBTQ classmates in danger.
After the State Board of Education presented on topics like teacher retention and state test scores, Representative Jamie Allard invited the board's student advisors to speak.
I'm not sure what the parameters of this conversation are, if they have to include what has been talked about in this presentation or...
Felix Myers is a junior at Sitka High School.
You have an open parameter. Go ahead.
Awesome. Okay. Great. Thank you. I just wanted to first address some of the legislation that has been recently introduced by our governor.
Last week, Dunleavy introduced what he calls his parental rights bill. It would require written permission from parents before students could change their names or pronouns at school, take a sex education class, or join a club related to gender or sexuality. The bill is unlikely to pass. It wasn't on the agenda for Wednesday's meeting. Maggie Cothran is a sophomore from Anchorage. She's also a student advisor who was there for the presentation.
I have friends who don't come out to their parents because they don't feel safe. They don't feel that their parents will accept them and be who they want to be. And to have that forcefully come out, I think it's going to have a lot of negative consequences that you may not realize.
Myers says those negative consequences could include a higher risk of suicide. Nearly half of LGBTQ youth in Alaska seriously considered suicide in the past year, according to a recent survey by the nonprofit Trevor Project. He says that's why it was so important to speak at the committee meeting.
It was scary, but I felt it needed to be done.
Dunleavy's bill would require school districts to separate student locker room and bathroom facilities by gender assigned at birth, provide access to single-stall restrooms, or take other measures to address, quote, the physical safety and privacy of students, end quote. But Myers says his transgender and non-binary classmates have appreciated their access to gender-neutral bathrooms.
I know that support for them has been immense, and the ability to feel respected in their classrooms when their pronouns are used correctly.
Cothran says other youth leaders around the state support policies that affirm queer and trans students' identities. She told the committee about the Alaska Association for Student Government's resolution last year to create gender-neutral bathrooms at Wasilla High School. The students emphasized that their views are their own, and that they weren't speaking on behalf of the state board. But they're glad they shared a student perspective with legislators.
We are students right now. We also have to think about the students in the future. And, like, our world is changing, and the idea of expression and becoming who we are is new. Like, people are finally being more open and more, like, being able to express themselves.
Cothran says she hopes that acceptance continues to grow. In Juneau, I'm Katie Anastas.
Today, the Anchorage Assembly filed its lawsuit against Mayor Dave Bronson, trying to force the disclosure of records related to a former department head who fabricated many of his professional qualifications. The Anchorage Assembly authorized the lawsuit against the administration in February. It had tried for months to get the administration to share its investigation into how Joe Gerace was hired to lead Anchorage Health Department. Mayor Dave Bronson has maintained that his administration legally cannot disclose the documents or discuss the matter because city codes and the state constitution's right to privacy privacy guarantee confidentiality of personnel records. Of Friday's development, a spokesman for the mayor said the administration is reviewing it and will follow the required legal process. In its appeal to Anchorage Superior Court, the Assembly argues that the records sought after are not personnel records at all and therefore aren't confidential. Gerace resigned in August as Alaska Public Media and American Public Media were exposing his false professional credentials, which included an inflated military rank and college degrees he didn't earn. Separately, the Assembly has repeatedly asked Bronson to publicly address concerns about his leadership amid the procession of executives resigning or being fired, toxic workplace allegations, misuse of city funds, and illegal overreaches of executive power. Bronson has repeatedly declined, lumping these wider concerns under the umbrella of confidential personnel matters. The commissioner of Alaska's Department of Fish and Game says preservation is the priority amidst struggling fisheries around the state. As KMXT's Brian Venua reports, the forum kicked off the second day of Comfish in Kodiak earlier today.
Doug Vincent Lang is the commissioner of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. He opened his presentation sharing concerns about Chinook and chum salmon stocks across the state. Salmon populations across most areas of the state have been struggling with particular concerns for Chinook.
King salmon are pretty much depressed across our state. I think most people know that.
Some examples he provided were subsistence fishery closures in Cook Inlet last year and the Nooshinggak River's Chinook struggles near Bristol Bay. Vincent Lang mentioned intercept fisheries such as Area M, where harvested fish have genetic roots from multiple areas, are starting to become more of a concern as well.
We don't always have complete consensus at the end of the decision, but at least people are coming together at a meeting and trying to find at least grudging consent to move forward on issues.
Another big topic for Vincent Lang was fishery disaster declarations. Nearly two dozen disaster designations were approved by the U.S. Commerce Department last year. Vincent Lang says it's a slow process to get that funding, but he hopes to push Congress to speed up their end of the process and get relief as soon as possible.
These are long drawn out processes that we're trying to work with Congress to somewhat speed up so that we're not in this endless loop of waiting for money to come up.
Vincent Lang says after a tough few years for some of the state's fisheries that have experienced closures, like Bering Sea crabbers, Fish and Game is ready for when there is a surplus significant enough for harvest again. The department is working with fisherfolk on research to keep them engaged during the closures.
The important objective of that is to have a fishery at the end of it. And if all fishermen are out of business or gone, that's not a good outcome.
He says the department is starting to see hints of growth for Bering Sea crab, but the long-term patterns for Chinook statewide are still a major concern. They're starting to do more research on the effects of hatcheries on wild stocks in the ocean. Vincent Lang also covered other topics during his presentation, including bycatch in the Bering Sea, budget increases, and border enforcement. In Kodiak, I'm Brian Venua.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, dogs weren't the only ones on the Iditarod Trail this week as human-powered racers arrived in Nome Wednesday.
First night was negative 30 degrees out on the Yetna River, and a lot of folks got frostbite, and a lot of folks got eliminated immediately. And
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Grant applications are now being accepted for tribal justice grants through the U.S. Department of Justice. Coordinated Tribal Assistance Solicitation, or CETAS grants, fund tribal courts and tribal law enforcement, open to federally recognized tribes across Alaska. Applications are open until March 21st. Learn more at atjrc.org/CTAS. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tribal Justice Resource Center.
Kenai River Sport Fishing Association founder Bob Penny died earlier this week at his winter home in Indian Wells, California. He was 90. Penny was a powerhouse in the worlds of fishing and state politics, and his unrelenting advocacy for Kenai River king salmon often put him at the center of the so-called Cook Inlet Fish Wars. KDLL's Sabine Pooks has this remembrance.
Penny moved to Alaska in its early years as a state to manage a lumberyard in Anchorage.
I mean, he loved the state. He moved here, like I said, in 51 and didn't have a dime.
Henry Penny says his dad was always a big fisherman. But it wasn't until 1976 when he had his first big close encounter with the Kenai River King. The two were together, and Henry caught a 60-pound fish.
when we got it up next to the boat, the look on my father's face, his eyes were as big as dinner plates.
Henry says that was the beginning of a long passion for king salmon preservation.
That definitely, if you'll pardon the pun, set the hook. And he has been addicted to that river ever since. And that's why he fought so hard to try and save the habitat.
In the 1980s, Bob Penny founded the Kenai River Sport Fishing Association, or CRISA, a sport fishing advocacy group based in Soldotna with a mission to conserve Kenai River kings. He also served a term on the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, which oversees fishing in Alaska's federal waters. Penny spent winters in California and summers in Soldotna, where he had a home on the river. Here he is in a 2021 tribute video posted by CRISA.
My heart and soul is on this river, and I think it always will be.
King salmon like the one the Pennies caught 50 years ago are much more rare today. But Penny's longtime friend Eldon Mulder says his advocacy for Kenai River salmon continued through his life.
As he always told me, I just want to make sure, Eldon, that my kids and my grandkids have the same opportunities that you and I do.
And he said he walked the walk. On his own property, Penny was an early installer of light-penetrating boardwalks to allow vegetation to grow underneath, and installed walkways down to the river to limit bank erosion. Penny's fight to preserve kings put him in direct conflict with Cook Inlet commercial fishermen, particularly East Side set netters who fish for sockeye, but who Penny's had caught too many kings in their nets close to shore. He tried to get set netting banned in urban areas in a 2016 ballot initiative, which the Alaska Supreme Court later ruled unconstitutional. As king salmon counts have continued to decline, set netters have faced more and more limitations on their fishery each year. Although he didn't have his own ambitions for political office, Penny was a political powerhouse, a good friend to Senators Ted Stevens and Lisa Murkowski, and a big backer to candidates like Governor Mike Dunleavy, who he helped elect with large donations in 2018 and again last year. Penny's friend Tim Navarre of Kenai says there was more to the fisherman than his sport fish advocacy and his politics. He contributed to local Kenai Peninsula nonprofits like the Challenger Learning Center and the Kenai Peninsula Foundation.
People would just have to come up and say, Bob, can I get a little help? And a lot of times, like I said, he'd come up with initiatives himself to help nonprofits here on the peninsula raise additional funds for themselves with his help.
Penny also owned Penco Properties, a real estate brokerage company based in Anchorage, and he helped found the Alaska Resource Development Council. Eldon Mulder says Penny was a force of nature. The two met when Mulder was working in the legislature, and Penny was raising money for Anchorage's bid to host the Winter Olympics.
If he sensed that there was a gap or a hole that needed to be addressed, he jumped right in with both hands and both feet, and he'd work to make sure that that deficiency was addressed.
He says they traveled the world together. Even in his old age, Penny was insistent on keeping up.
And the only thing that made him mad is if you offered to carry his bag. He refused to allow anybody to help him.
Penny leaves behind 4 children, 10 grandchildren, and 7 great-grandchildren, according to a statement from his family. Henry Penny says the family plans to do a local celebration of life in the summer. In Kenai, I'm Sabine Pooks.
For years, coastal Alaska communities, a majority of them Alaska Native villages, have contended with erosion eating away at the land and pushing more and more of the coast into the sea. It's led to a growing field of research into what can be done to address the problem. A new article from nonprofit environmental news outlet Grist takes a look at what's at stake in these communities and what residents are doing to combat the loss of land. Saima Siddick is the author of the story and joins us now. Hi, Saima.
Hi, Wesley. Thanks for having me on.
So can you set the scene for us in these communities? What are community members in Dillingham and other coastal communities having to contend with due to erosion?
Yeah, it's really striking. If you walk down the beach in a lot of these places, you can just see the earth crumbling away. Huge bluffs are just not where you left them the day before. Rocks and trees fall over the edge. Landmarks are disappearing in some cases. These points that people used to use to navigate are just not there anymore to guide them. So definitely a big problem, threatening a lot of infrastructure, a lot of people's livelihoods, and just overall causing a lot of havoc and hardship.
And your story lays out a lot of local proposals to mitigate the impact of erosion. One of them has to do with reinforcing melting permafrost with something called thermosiphons. Can you explain what those are and how they address erosion?
Yeah, this is really interesting. So this is something that Tom Rappins at the University of Alaska at Anchorage is looking into. So thermosiphons are these large tubes that stick partly into the ground and partly out of the ground. And in them, there is a substance that alternates between being a gas and being a liquid. So when the substance is, when it gets cold, it condenses and it falls to the bottom of the tube, which is in the ground. And if the ground is warm, then that substance then heats up and turns back into a gas and goes up to the top of the tube where it's colder. And in doing that, it delivers heat out of the ground and into the air. And so it sort of keeps the ground frozen. These have been used in some inland sites. And there are some people who are suggesting that maybe they could be more widely used and maybe they could be part of a solution for erosion along coastlines.
I know that scientists made another observation that has to do with this correlation between where subsistence hunters process marine mammals and the rate of erosion. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, for sure. So subsistence hunters have noticed that places on beaches where they process marine mammals after they catch them, those places tend to be resistant to erosion. And some scientists are wondering if there are oils that leak out of the mammals that might be responsible for that. And they're wondering if similar compounds could be found in other oils, like maybe even waste cooking oil. So this could be a way to possibly, you know, repurpose your French fry oil. After you eat your fast food, you could isolate these compounds from the leftover oil, and maybe that could be a way to stabilize the beaches.
And in response to erosion, several Alaska villages in recent years have already begun the process of relocating their communities. Can you talk a little bit about discussions researchers are having around portable housing?
Well, my understanding, and I must say I'm not an Alaska, I'm not a native person myself, but my understanding is that back in the history of a lot of these groups, they used to move from one place to another depending on the season to keep themselves synced up with where natural resources were available. And some researchers are wondering, is it worth considering a move back to that sort of mobile lifestyle? There's another researcher I talked to who is currently applying for funding to have conversations with Indigenous communities and ask them if they think living in structures that are meant to be moved when conditions necessitate that, if that could be a viable strategy.
And in addition to coastal villages losing physical land, you mentioned there is a historical component to what's being lost in primarily Alaskan Native communities. What did locals tell you about what's at stake if the erosion continues to eat away at the coast?
Well, you know, it just really changes the way of life that they've had for a long time, I think. These are people who have a really long and deep relationship with the coastline and for whom the resources that they get from the ocean are deeply important. And so having to change their whole lifestyle and their whole communities, having to rearrange their whole communities in response to this problem, it's not as simple as it might be in some parts of the world. You know, if you buy all your food at the grocery store, then it might not be such a problem to just start going to another grocery store, but it's not that simple when you're used to relying on the land a bit more.
Well, Saima Siddick is the author of the Grist article, How Alaska's Coastal Communities Are Racing Against Erosion. Saima, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. There are many ways to support your local public media station. Donate now and arrange to make a planned gift as a bequest. Your legacy will stretch from today to many tomorrows.
Alaska Pacific University offers an education as an adventure in living and learning. Students are the core of APU, representing the aspirations and collective wisdom of our community. Education is collaborative, innovative, and transformational, encouraging student development and honoring Alaska's Indigenous heritage while offering a unique and powerful educational experience. Learn more at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
While the Iditarod sled dog race was making statewide, national, and international news over the past week, another group of trail enthusiasts was blazing a path alongside the mushers. On Wednesday, Marone Golfman crossed the finish line of the Iditarod Trail Invitational in downtown Nome. The human-powered race, which follows the path of the famed dog race, saw Golfman finish Wednesday at 12:51 p.m. The Iditarod Trail Invitational, a bike, ski, and foot race, travels from Kinnick Lake near Anchorage to the interior community of McGrath, continuing to the Bering Sea before reaching the trail's conclusion in Nome. The race travels along the historic Iditarod Trail and, according to race organizers, requires self-sufficiency and resilience to make it through up to 30 days and nights of freezing temperatures and inclement weather. Golfman hails from Anchorage. He left Kinnick Lake on February 26th and finished in Nome with a moving time of 6 days, 21 hours, and 5 minutes. He had a resting time of 10 days, 1 hour, 34 minutes. He averaged 5.9 miles per hour while underway and covered an average of 57.1 miles a day. He says conditions were treacherous from the start.
We went right into the first night, was negative 30 degrees out on the Yetna River, and a lot of folks got frostbite, and a lot of folks got eliminated immediately, and pushing through that. And then day two, we hit this big snowstorm, and so we all contended with that. Myself and the other person right up front, you know, we were able to get up and over the Alaska Range before the snowstorm hit us, but we were just like everyone else contending with that, and 80 mile an hour winds, and it was white out snowing.
Golfman says conditions warmed up on Monday, and that brought a different kind of challenge to the trail.
I clocked 49 degrees on my thermometer at the peak of one day, and so everything turned to slush, right? And it was just, there was no biking to be done. So ended up spending almost 2 days pushing my bike, and my every bit of gear got wet because the second day it rained. And I was pushing my bike through about 7 hours of rain, and so everything got drenched, and my feet got pretty messed up from that because, you know, boots were soaking wet, and so I got a bit of trench foot and foot rot.
Riding on his 907 Lynx bike, Golfman was racing to raise funds for the Ride to Endure project.
This was my second annual ride for the Ride to Endure campaign, which is a charity that I started a couple years back. It is raising funds and awareness for ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease.
Golfman's uncle is 6 years into his battle with that disease. Golfman previously lived with him and was his primary caregiver. It was the experience of taking care of him that Golfman said inspired him to pursue his passion of becoming a bike racer. A total of 98 competitors took part in this year's Invitational. Three more bikers finished side by side by side Thursday night, just before Iditarod musher Mike Williams Jr. crossed under the Burled Arch in Nome. Meanwhile, Alaska's State Education Department has selected 5 tribes for a pilot program that will allow tribes to open new independent schools. The State Tribal Education Compacting Program was established under Senate Bill 34, which passed the legislature and was signed into law by Governor Dunleavy last year. The 5 selected tribes each receive grant funding to start their school over the next handful of years through a compact agreement with the state's Department of Education and Early Development. The tribes can set their own curriculum and schedule, though receive guidance from the Alaska Federation of Natives as the program moves forward. Supporters say the program will improve education for Alaska Native students. It's part of a larger push to bring more culturally relevant lessons into the classroom to support Indigenous students. Sea Alaska Heritage Institute holds a conference each year that brings together educators to train them on how to bring Alaska Native culture into their lessons. The University of Alaska Fairbanks also offers standards for culturally responsive teaching set out by several Alaska Native organizations and tribes. According to the State Education Department, the schools would be open to all students from kindergarten through high school. The tribes selected for the pilot program include Ketchikan Indian Community, the Central the Central Council of Tlingit Nahida Indian Tribes of Alaska, King Island Native Community, Kinnick Tribe, and Inupiat Community of the Arctic Slope. Three Bears Alaska is now the owner of the Gold Hill Liquor Store in Esther, a small community near Fairbanks. The Wasilla-based retail chain closed the deal on Wednesday, then began replacing signage and equipment and inventory in time to reopen this morning as the 20th Three Bears store in Alaska. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Workers have been hustling for the past couple of days to get the Three Bears store in Esther ready to reopen in a spruced-up convenience store. Company spokesperson Jim Kolb said Thursday the workers were on track to complete the job in time to open the doors today.
We'll hang some new banners over the existing signs, and you know, people know it's going to be a Shell fuel station and it's a Three Bears.
Kolb says Three Bears is following the same strategy it did with two other gas station convenience-type stores the company acquired over the past year.
That's what we did down in Ketchikan not too long ago. We basically closed down for 2 days and swapped some stuff over and got our systems into place and opened back up as the Three Bears.
He says the initial work's being done to enable the Esther store to be reopened quickly. He says it'll get a complete remodel after a few months of operation.
Oh, it'll be a full facelift.
Kolb says the company's done similar renovations at other stores Three Bears recently acquired in Trapper Creek and Ninilchik. He says those were part of the company's expansion around the state, financed mainly by a recapitalization deal it reached last year with a Seattle-based private equity firm.
We've become used to, things that fall on our lap and we take them over.
The store in Esther is the company's 20th, with new stores in North Pole and Ketchikan also in the works. Kolb says Three Bears buys in bulk for its Alaska stores to maximize economies of scale, and he says the company passes along those savings to customers. He expects they'll notice that the next time they come in.
It definitely makes a difference going from a mom-and-pop brand single business to more of a corporation style, but we still like to retain that small town feel.
Kolb says customers also will notice another big change at the Esther store, the closure of Gold Hill Express, the drive-through coffee shop that's housed in an iconic red railroad caboose parked on the west side of the 1.8-acre property. He says the company won't reopen the caboose because it now sells coffee in the store. He says he's already heard a lot about that.
That's a hot topic on social media.
Kolb says he's also gotten feedback about the caboose from regulars who stop by there every morning for a cuppa and a nosh. He's also heard from a local historical society and a writer who wants to compile the history of the rail car. But for now, all he can say is...
The official word is undetermined. We don't know what we're going to do with it yet.
Kolb says the company's long encouraged customers to suggest products they'd like to see on the store's shelves, and he says it'll also welcome suggestions on what to do with the caboose. In Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Katie Anastas in Juneau, Reagan Miller in Ketchikan, Brian Venwa in Kodiak, Jeremy Shea in Anchorage, Sabine Pooks in Kenai, Greg Knight in Nome, and Tim Ellis in Delta Junction. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Wesley Early. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Monies generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. Public media is about you, the community we serve. Thank you for tuning in. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.